You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Well, gang, it's been a heck of a year. We had the pandemic, we had that pesky U.S. presidential election. But for our year-end worldly wrap-up, looking back, looking forward, that we know all of you love, we're going to kind of skip over the pandemic and the U.S. presidential election, because there were a lot of other things that actually happened this year that were kind of important. And we all kind of talked about the pandemic and the election to death at this point. So that's Today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. We're going to talk about some things that happened this year other than the pandemic and the election that you might have maybe forgotten or that kind of got lost in the haze of lockdowns and all of that stuff that our life has now become. And then we're going to talk about looking forward. We're going to talk about some interesting things that might be happening in the coming year. So I'm here, as always, with Alex Ward and Jen Kirby.
Hello.
Morning.
Yeah. So we've had a year, guys.
One could say that.
One could indeed.
I've been asleep the whole time. What's been going on?
All right, I'll bite. What's a pandemic? So longtime Worldly listeners know we like to do our end of year episode as sort of a retrospective in the first half, looking back at the year that was. And in the second half, we're going to talk about the year that is to come. This is going to be our last episode of 2020. We are going to take some well-deserved and much-needed time off, and we will be back in January with brand new, fresh episodes talking about whatever the world looks like then. But for now, we are going to go kind of in a round here, and each of us has decided to pick one kind of big thing that happened this year other than the pandemic and the election that we think was, you know, really important or that kind of got overlooked or that we think just, you know, is worth kind of giving some attention to. So who wants to go first? Jen, how about you? Go for it.
Sure. So for this, I thought I'd pick a recent event that has kind of been overshadowed because of the aforementioned election and and pandemic, or maybe vaccine good news at least. But Ethiopia, which is in Eastern Africa, has been the source of some strife for the past month or so. And the situation is still really murky, but I think it's important because it has profound regional implications for the security situation in East Africa, but also humanitarian implications. So it's a bit of a complicated situation, but beginning in early November, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, sent in troops to this region of Ethiopia known as Tigray. He had claimed that the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, which is the opposition group, had attacked Ethiopian military base. And so he needed to, you know, quell the security situation. The TPLF has denied this and basically said this is a pretense to go in because there had been long brewing tensions for some time. It's a bit complicated, but Prime Minister Abiy came into power in 2018 as this young, bright, democratic reformer. He immediately instituted all of these reforms. But in taking power, he kind of kicked the TPLF, or their associates out of the government, and they had ruled for a very long time before him. So there had been tensions brewing for a long time. And so what happened is, basically, fast forwarding to November, troops had been sent in. You know, there was a mass blackout, so it was really hard to have communication. So we really don't fully know what happened on the ground.
Like a communications blackout, like from the government, or like the a power blackout?
Yeah, it was ostensibly from the government. The prime minister has claimed, you know, it was a cyber attack, or there was, you know, infrastructure damage, but it very much seems to come from the government. This is something that has happened in Ethiopia before, including by this government.
Gotcha.
Essentially, what... You know, at the end of November, the Ethiopian prime minister declared that he'd taken back Mekelle, which is the capital of the Tigray region, and basically said, war's over, everything is good. But we really do not know the situation, and there is a lot of concern that this could become a kind of insurgency. We know that there was violence, but it's very hard right now to know, like, whom was fighting whom. You know, there's been refugees who have fled to Sudan, about 50,000 in the past month, who've, you know, claimed that, you know, there was assassinations, that there was looting, rioting. There's also concerns of mass displacement within Tigray. And there are also longstanding refugee camps. About 100,000 Eritreans live in the Tigray region, and the access to humanitarian aid is in question. So there's kind of this... a lot of uncertainty. You know, the prime minister of Ethiopia visited the region over the weekend. It was basically like, all good here, but there's been some concerns from humanitarian agencies that that's not the case. So we have a very uncertain situation right now. I should say it bodes pretty poorly for the region.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Abiy Ahmed, the prime minister, didn't he win the Nobel Peace Prize recently?
He did indeed. He won it last year in 2019 because he had sort of been this young rising star. Like I said, he came to power after, mass protests in Ethiopia had pushed out the long-standing government, which was seen as corrupt and kind of repressive. And the prime minister came in and he freed all these political prisoners and, you know, was saying no more communications blackouts and things like that. He also resolved a long-standing conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea.
Right.
And he helped mediate, you know, with pro-democracy protesters in Sudan as they were transitioning there. So he was kind of seen as this bright light for the region. And now, a year later, the Nobel Peace Prize curse has caught up with him.
Right. And we've seen this happen before.
Yes. And there's a lot of questions about his rule. And we should say that part of the reason this conflict came about was because the Ethiopian prime minister had postponed elections that were supposed to happen this summer. He claimed because of the coronavirus, and, you know, people in the Tigray region rejected this. So that was also fueled the tension. So there are some questions about his potential anti-democratic tendencies.
Yeah, Jen, I'm really glad that you picked that for your one big thing this year. We on Worldly haven't actually had a chance to do a deep dive into that conflict, but mainly because our sister podcast, Today Explained, did a really great episode on that. And we'll make sure to link to that in the show notes. So, all right, Alex. Your big thing. What you got?
Yeah. If you guys remember, Japan's prime minister, Abe Shinzo, who was in power for 8 years and tried to transform the country and, in fact, did in many ways, resigned out of nowhere. Do you remember that?
Yeah. It was like randomly all of a sudden one day he was like, oh, by the way, I'm out.
Yeah.
What was that all about? What happened?
So when Abe had been prime minister before and quit for multiple reasons, but part of the reason he left initially was because he has sort of like chronic stomach issues. This is, again, the reason he cited for leaving after 8 years in August. Some people buy it, some people don't. The reason they don't buy it is because there's always like corruption issues surrounding his time in power and his party. And on top of that, it seemed like he might be losing some general support or, you know, wasn't handling the coronavirus well, whatever it may be. Still, it could be true, right? Abe has cited it before. People around him say he has it, and it made it hard for him to do his job, right? And just imagine, and this is not to make light of a situation, but imagine you're trying to run a country that's struggling economically and dealing with the coronavirus and also doing intense diplomatic negotiations, and then you need to go to the bathroom constantly or you're like constantly in pain. That's just really hard to do, especially when Japan is such an important and massive country. And so he stepped down in August. And now the prime minister is a guy named Suga Yoshihide, who was basically his right-hand man, who held the job of cabinet secretary, which for Americans is roughly like a job combining White House press secretary and chief of staff. But it's really the person who, like, behind the scenes makes the government run.
So Jared Kushner.
Huh, sure.
Is that not a good comparison?
No, just because, like, this is really someone who is has their hands in everything, speaks to the people twice a day, like does two press conferences, is in charge of like...
So definitely not Jared Kushner then.
Right. Like is in charge of knocking heads on, you know, in the legislature and making sure things move forward. And he's a very different kind of Japanese prime minister because of his background. I mean, he's a rag to riches story. You know, grew up, you know, went, had been at a part-time job to go to not one of the top universities in Japan, like got into office by, you know, knocking on doors and basically wearing his shoes thin, and is just seen as like this wily operator. Some people sort of see him as a Dick Cheney type figure, but people who are close to him is like, he's a really nice dude. He's down to earth. He's just like a staunch patriot. And the reason this matters is twofold. One is that Abe was transforming Japan, as I alluded to earlier, by trying to modernize the country's economy, which had been stagnating for quite some time. But for my purposes, more importantly, he tried to completely transform the way of Japan's military acted. After World War II, Japan went into a self-defense force, and, you know, the constitution that the U.S. helped write was basically like, you guys can't be aggressive anymore. And Japan followed that for decades. But Abe, in part because North Korea and China got Japan out of that rut, and started to buy weapon systems and a whole bunch of other, and like changing policies in the military to make it more of like a traditional armed force that any other country has.
And Alex is being humble here by not mentioning it, but he did an incredibly well done reported feature that we will also link to in the show notes on Abe's, you know, basically remilitarization program for Japan. So Alex knows what he's talking about here, and it has a great piece on that and also a great profile on the new prime minister. So we'll link to that also. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so with Abe leaving, people were wondering what would happen to that project. Suga, by all accounts, is, you know, believes in it, is going to continue it, and he's trying to also do some of those economic reforms. One of the big things is he's trying to change just like the administrative practices of the country. One of the things that surprised me is that the government, like most of its documents are still in hard paper form being faxed and like handed to people. They're not really into email. And on top of that, to sign official documents, you have to use a hanko, which is like basically your family signature or your specific signature, but you like stamp it. Now they're trying to do this all online. So this seems small, but it would actually like make the government much more efficient and the economy better. But, and this is a long thing for Suga, but he's struggling at the moment because he came in with such welfare. Like, he came in to fix what Abe had left behind. And he's, again, this sort of rags-to-riches story. But he is not doing really well with the coronavirus at the moment. The country's going through its third spike. The economy is crumbling. And so the guy who is sort of seen like Super Suga, right? Like, the guy who's been doing all of this great stuff from behind the scenes.
Wait, do they really call him that?
Yeah, Super Suga.
Okay, that's amazing. I love that.
They now, like, now it's his time to shine. Like, he's the guy in charge. He's got about a year to also make his case to be prime minister and not, like, just this caretaker for a year. It's not going too well.
What happens in a year?
There's going to be a new election.
Ah, gotcha.
And so So there, even he sort of says, like, I'm just here to, you know, fill in for the moment after Abe is gone. I'm totally going to move aside. But people would say the best case to become the next prime minister is to do a really good job as prime minister.
That seems like a fair metric.
Yeah, and right now he's just not doing too well. So this is interesting because, again, you know, for American purposes, like, Japan is just a staunch ally, a key anchor for the U.S. goals in Asia. And if it's struggling and it's going through a power crisis, and Japan has a history of having like people in power for short periods of time, for like transitions, like that, this could cause that turbulence again. And Abe had sort of stopped because he was in power for 8 years. So that was a really long monologue, but I think it's just a really important thing to understand.
No, that's really useful and a fascinating thing that happened and I think, you know, didn't get a ton of coverage. I also should have mentioned, and I apologize, Jen, that I didn't. Jen also has done really great reporting on Ethiopia.
Yeah.
She did a really awesome Q&A with Jan Egeland, who's the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council,
yes.
If I have that right. He's mm-hmm. also the recipient of a really insane, wild song by Ylvis about him, but Jen did a great Q&A with him about what's actually happening on the ground because his organization is very active trying to help cope with the refugee issue. So we'll make sure and link to that. So yeah, Jen also knows her business on Ethiopia.
And sorry, if you don't know Ildis, they're the guys who did What Does the Fox Say? So definitely recommend you listen to it.
Yeah, they have a song. It has one section that's, there's one line that's a bit homophobic that I kind of really, really wish they didn't include. But beyond that, it's just a wild song about this guy who does humanitarian work. And it's like this big rock song, pop song. Anyway, we will probably not link to that in the show notes, but you're welcome to Google it. All right, so I will do my third big thing that happened. And mine is the Russian constitutional amendments that got pushed through this summer that, among a whole bunch of other things, allow Vladimir Putin to remain in power potentially until 2036.
Classic.
Yeah. So this was a really big deal. And Jen actually did a bunch of reporting on this too, if I remember correctly, but I am going to talk about it. Yeah, this was a really big deal. This is essentially the culmination of a 20-year-long project of Putin's to kind of expand his power. Basically, these constitutional amendments revamp the entire constitution. It's basically Putin's own version of the constitution. He has been in power either as the president of Russia or the prime minister. He kind of goes back and forth depending on, what year it is. But he has been in power basically since 1999. And this is kind of a part of a long tradition in Russia and in the Soviet Union. They went through 7 constitutions in the 20th century. So everyone from Lenin, Stalin, Brezhnev, Boris Yeltsin, all kind of remade and made changes to this basic law. Putin himself had actually, what's interesting, as recently as 2018, had kind of proudly, pointed out that he had never altered the constitution. But all of a sudden, it was getting to where he might essentially, age out of the system because he's been in power so long. So he pushed through these changes. And for me, I think this is a really, really huge kind of development that, again, because of all the other things we've been dealing with, hasn't gotten kind of as much attention or has kind of, fallen by the wayside. But it's just a huge development for Russia. For one thing, Putin himself has kind of led this project to, I hate having to say this, but make Russia great again, to kind of, restore the kind of Soviet expansion, kind of glory, control, era of Russia. He, annexed Crimea, invaded Ukraine. But he's also, kind of put forth this really kind of conservative vision of Russia, emphasizing Russia's traditional values, which includes, opposition to gay marriage, championing the Russian Orthodox Church, denouncing Western-style liberalism. He's really kind of put his stamp hardcore on Russia, both internally and in terms of its foreign relations. And so these changes, it's not just also that it allows him to remain in power. Like, that's the biggest one and the one that I think is obviously the most concerning, but it's the most concerning because of some of the other ones. There were like over 200 changes to the Constitution. So ranging from basically precluding the legalization of same-sex marriage, enshrining faith in God as a core value bequeathed to Russians by their ancestors. It elevates the ethnic Russian majority, designates Russian as the language of the state-forming ethnicity. Russia is a super multi-ethnic, multilingual country. And so it's very much this like Putin stamp on saying like the future of Russia is mine. It is, how I define it. And it's really concerning, I think. Russia may not be the economic, or military superpower. It definitely still is a nuclear power. But, it may not be the massive kind of juggernaut it once was. But, Putin still has a lot of ways to influence the world. We obviously saw in the 2016 election, the meddling in the U.S. elections. Putin has also meddled in a whole bunch of other elections in Europe. So to me, these constitutional amendments, which, passed, of course, easily, are really, really deeply concerning for the future of Russia, for the future of Europe, and for the future of global stability. So that's my one big thing.
What at least when I remember the reporting, one of the details that stuck out to me was that Putin didn't actually need a referendum to get those changes through. He wanted a referendum. Isn't that right? Like he actually because his popularity and his support has been slipping, you know, the Russians are a little sick of him. It seemed like he wanted to go through the performative act of this referendum to kind of make it seem that he was sort of had the will of the people at his back. Is that sort of the right take?
No, that's absolutely right. Because he's Putin, because he, you know, has such a tight grip on power in terms of like the institutions and you know, the control mechanisms, could have just, you know, made this happen himself without putting it to a vote, without, you know, any sort of, you know, asking permission. But yeah, he wanted this like veneer of legitimacy, right? He wants it to look like, oh, you know, the people support me as this founding father of modern Russia. And, you know, they support all these changes because they, you know, they support my leadership and they want my stability and all of this. You know, the vote, as, you know, always in Russia, was very likely not super on the up and up. But yeah, you know, he still kind of continues to hold these kinds of votes to kind of pretend democracy, to make it look like, no, you know, I'm just a normal democratic leader and I have the support of the people, when it's essentially not the case at all. And he's just forcing things through. To that note as well, some of these amendments, I mean, they also make Putin immune from prosecution once he does step down. It also leaves open a whole bunch of other pathways to a continued grip on power if he doesn't, you know, remain president and, you know, run for another term. So every kind of one of these amendments is a way for Putin to kind of establish that he is this, you know, I am the father of Russia. I am, you know, the savior of modern Russia. And this is my country. And yeah, that's a great point that you made, that it's this kind of veneer of false democratic legitimacy that he uses to kind of justify these super autocratic moves.
It's really exciting to know that the U.S. will get to contend with Vladimir Putin in Russia and Xi Jinping in China for a really, really long time.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. You know, say what you will about the chaos of our presidential election. We actually did have an election. It actually wasn't rife with corruption and, you know, election interference and meddling and vote changing and, you know, parties cheating.
Stop the steal, Jen. Stop the steal.
Yeah, stop the steal. You know, so say what you will about the mess of democracy, you know, at least we do have changes of leadership and, you know, ostensibly, hopefully, peaceful transitions of power. But, you know, as messy as it was, I'll take that any day over having the same one guy in charge for, like, probably the rest of his life.
If I remember correctly, too, in Russia, they were, like, voting on out of, like, tree trunks and out of, like, people's, like, cars. So how's that for voter fraud?
Yeah, exactly. It's a little wild. They also had, like, raffles. Like, if you go vote, you could win prizes. I was like, I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to like pay people to vote. But I mean, okay, great job, everyone, on the not democracy. But, you know, this definitely has, you know, has a lot of implications too for people in Russia, right? Who would very much, there are a lot of people who would very much like to, you know, have a legitimate democracy. And people like Alexei Navalny, who try to push for that, get poisoned, probably by Putin. So it's a big, you know, it's a big deal. He's going to be around for a long time. And we will, like Alex said, continue to deal with him and folks like Xi Jinping for a while. I think that's a good place for us to break. We're going to take a quick, well, break. And after said break, each of us is going to pick one interesting storyline around the world that we're watching in 2021, again, other than the pandemic.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free.
Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
All right, welcome back, worldly listeners. We, in the first part of the show, talked about three big things that happened this year other than the pandemic and the election that kind of went under the radar. Now, for this half, we are going to talk about three interesting storylines around the world that we're watching for the coming year. Again, other than the pandemic, obviously, we are all going to be watching closely at what happens in terms of vaccine distribution, continued, you know, infection rates and deaths and just the entire story that has consumed all of our lives. But beyond that, there are lots of interesting things that could potentially happen, that are scheduled to happen around the world. So, Jen, what's your one interesting storyline you're watching?
I am watching the end of the Angela Merkel era.
Ooh, good
in Germany.
One.
Sad.
Yes. We knew this was coming, but now it will happen next year. Angela Merkel had decided to step down as the leader of her party at the end of 2018, I believe. And she was not going to run again for chancellor in 2021. So we knew this day was coming, but now it's here. And this is, I think, really, really important because we actually don't know, have really a sense of who her successor will be. And I'll get to that in a second. But Angela Merkel was kind of, especially during the Trump years, kind of the de facto leader of the free world. She has led Germany since 2005. So she is going to be seeing four U.S. presidents. So she has really left her mark in Germany, on the European Union, and the world. She, you know, made Germany a powerful member of the European Union. She helped the bloc weather the Eurozone crisis during the migrant crisis in 2015-2016, where she did get a lot of political pressure. She still opened up Germany's doors, welcomed 1 million migrants. And so she really has shaped the country and I think the European Union. And now that she's gone, I think there is a sort of degree of uncertainty that hasn't quite been dealt with yet.
This is such a big deal. So I spent some time in Germany studying abroad and trying to learn the darn language. I was shocked by how many people in Germany would call Merkel Mutti, which is like a darling way of saying mother. Like she's seen as this like incredibly important, motherly, but in an authoritative way of the country. She is, as Jen rightly noted, like overseen that country over really strong periods and some pretty dark times. And so for her to leave is a massive loss for that country. It is a huge loss of sort of like a power structure of Europe and frankly just for world politics. Like someone who's been a stable person and democratically elected over a long period of time is a complete change, right? Like it's going to shift a lot of things. And so I'm totally with you. I think this is a massive story.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, and also, and I know we said we wouldn't talk about the pandemic, but I lied. You know, she's you know, Germany is struggling again. They just instituted a hardcore, you know, I think second or third, I think at this point, lockdown. They're struggling with rising coronavirus cases. But her leadership has been, I think, relatively speaking, compared to, well, at least the United States, but many other countries, has been really strong. You know, she she's hardcore, right? Like she, you know, she grew up and came of age in East Germany, you know, before the wall came down. I think her degree is, she has like a doctorate in quantum chemistry. You know, she worked as a researcher and published a bunch of scientific papers. So, you know, when the pandemic came along, she was, you know, really good at kind of putting out these statements. There was one kind of early on that kind of went viral where she's being just really straightforward with the people saying like, look, you know, this is serious. You need to take this seriously. And, you know, having someone who is a scientist or, you know, herself lead and be able to kind of, you know, translate some of the more technical, kind of confusing stuff of the pandemic to the people in a, you know, really clear, forthright manner, I think was super important. You know, and I think just her leadership in general, as you said, Jen, I totally agree with both of you said. I think it's going to be really, I don't want to say scary, I'm not trying to fearmonger, but it's a little concerning of, you know, what's going to come next and who's going to take the mantle of leadership in Germany.
Right. And I think the coronavirus is a really interesting development in this, because we should say that when Merkel made the decision to kind of step aside, politics in Germany were a little bit rough. Her party, which is the CDU.
Christian Democratic Union, right?
Yeah, exactly. Had faced some tough, you know, had struggled to make a government in 2017 and had done so with the Social Democrats, who are kind of this sort of center left. So they had this grand coalition. And Germans in general, I think, were kind of getting dissatisfied with this kind of blob. And Merkel's party was getting pressure, particularly from the right, and the rise of this, you know, far right party known as Alternative for Germany, or the AfD, which is kind of like a, you know, very anti-immigrant, very anti-Muslim party. And so we were seeing this fracturing of German politics on the right, but also on the left with the rise of the Greens. And so her party was getting like pretty badly defeated as we saw politics fracture. And then Merkel's chosen successor was this woman, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, which I heard it goes by AKK because it's a bit of a mouthful. She had taken over and was seen as the person who was going to be Merkel's successor. And then shortly into her tenure at the beginning of this year in February, she had to basically step down because her party in a state election had basically kind of made a pact with that far-right AfD party to elect a leader. And this was, you know, no. Like, they weren't, this is against sort of the party rules to partner with this far-right party. And so she had to step aside. And then this little thing called the coronavirus happened. And so they never really got around to re-electing the party leader, and they kept postponing it. It was supposed to happen in December. Now it's going to happen in January. So we don't even know who the leader of the CDU is going to be, who could potentially lead the party into the sort of post-Merkel era. But as you meant, but going back to the coronavirus, Merkel's popularity, despite Germany's difficulties right now, has increased because of her handling of the coronavirus and her kind of both sort of strict follow the science, but also really heartfelt appeals to the people. And that has helped her party. And at the same time, it has kind of lessened the threat of the far right party, in part because a lot of Germans kind of agreed with the policies of Merkel's government. But also, you know, people weren't talking about immigration as much, which was kind of the AfD's thing. And so the question will be, when the coronavirus crisis begins to subside, will Merkel's leadership kind of help the continuation of German politics, or will we see that fracturing again and a lot of uncertainty, because the elections are until September, and as we know, a lot can happen from now until then.
Alex, you're up. What's your big thing you're watching for?
Oh, I struggled with this one a lot to figure out, because there's so many things. I think, though, just because I've been laser focused on the Biden administration lately, I'm going to pick something related to it, and that is what many suspect will be a pretty robust policy to a forgotten region for U.S. foreign policy, which is Central and South America. The reason this matters is because it has been a generally neglected space for a really long time. I think I've said on this show before, but I'll repeat again. I think, you know, like 50 years down the line, as historians look on this era of, you know, post-9/11 foreign policy, they're going to be shocked at how much attention we paid to like the Middle East and a bunch of other regions and completely ignored the Western Hemisphere, despite it being arguably the most important for us in terms of trade, in terms of, you know, familial ties, in terms of values, in terms of a bunch of things. It makes perfect sense for us to care about Central and South America, and yet we have done very little except through the prism of immigration. And also, like, we don't like Cuba and Venezuela, and so we sanction it and whatever. Like, that's basically been our engagement. enter Joe Biden, who during the Obama years was sort of the envoy to Central America, traveled there pretty frequently, traveled to South America pretty frequently, has written a bunch of articles on like what he would want to do there, which is to somewhat, a lot of it's pretty traditional, right? Like, yes, fix immigration issues, but also, you know, send more aid to certain countries, improve governance. So then, like, basically solving the problems in those specific countries so there isn't a bunch of people that just think that they need to come to the United States for a better life or need to. And it seems like from people close to Biden, from and also just the fact that there's a bunch of former Obama people there, like, this is actually going to be a priority for him. And he was pushed, and he and other Democrats were pushed on this by Julian Castro, who was saying that this was an important issue to consider. And so it seems like this has worked. You now have Senator Tim Kaine, former vice presidential candidate, pretty important senator, writing op-eds being like, hey, Biden, follow through on this. You should do this. And having John Kerry in the White House, granted, in a climate czar role, but Kerry, importantly, in 2013, in an incredibly, I thought, undercovered statement, said the era of the Monroe Doctrine is over. The Monroe Doctrine being sort of the, from James Monroe, former president, who in a sense, and got known for it, was like telling other world powers at the time, this is our territory, the Western Hemisphere. This is our region of influence. Do not mess with us. This is our spot. And for Kerry to say that—
To quote Dirty Dancing, this is my dance space. This is your dance space.
Right. Nobody puts Kerry in a corner. And
exactly.
And so having sort of this team back together again, having Biden very openly care about this region— could be interesting and could actually be a place where he focuses more of his attention, especially as he's trying to wind down forever wars. And of course, there's a whole bunch of other things going on that require his time. So I'm not saying it's going to be the priority, but I think it'll be a more of a priority than in previous administrations. And it would also be a counter to the Trump years, right? Which they basically put up a wall or parts of a wall as to deal with immigration, did this whole sort of like third party deportation scheme, and just massive stuff on Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua on like trying to, in a sense, overthrow those regimes, although they're never explicitly stated. So I do think this is actually going to be an interesting thing to watch. And frankly, if it continues as people I'm talking to expect it to, a pretty important sea change in the way the U.S. has dealt with that region in terms of emphasis and content for a really long time.
Yeah. You know, I think to that point, one of the things that I think of as, you know, someone who is obsessed with, you know, the Cold War era and, you know, our kind of world history and U.S. foreign policy in the Cold War, you know, hearing that the U.S. is going to take more of an active role in Central and South America gives me a bit of a pause, right? Because, you know, obviously we would want that to be something that is beneficial, you know, not just for U.S. foreign policy interests, but for the people who live in those areas. And I will say that we don't have maybe the greatest track record, to put it mildly, of doing that second part of thinking about how these policies will, you know, how our intervention and involvement in the region will impact the people who live there, whether what they, you know, what we're doing is what they actually want, things like that. Obviously, I'm not saying that Biden is going to, you know, start refighting the Cold War and propping up, you know, repressive regimes to fight communists. That's not the world we live in. But, you know, I would just say that I hope that we operate in a way that is working, you know, with civil society groups and the people in these countries and not just, you know, picking winners and losers in terms of government leaders, you know, that there is actual accountability put in place when it comes to governance measures, tying that to aid or, you know, figuring out ways to make sure that our involvement doesn't make things worse at the very least. And Jen, I know you did some reporting. I don't remember if it was this year because what is time anymore, but I believe it was. You did a really great piece talking to a ton of experts and basically laying out, you know, what would a good U.S. policy towards Central and South America look like? And it was really eye-opening, so we'll make sure to link to that in the show notes as well, because even though it was a little while ago, it was really, really kind of deep dive into, like, okay, you say you have, you know, the attention of the president and they actually want to do a good policy. Like, what do you do? And talking to experts, so.
Yeah, and I think one of the big sort of takeaways that, if I remember correctly from doing that piece, which seems to have actually been last year, so I'm forgiven for forgetting some of it. But, you know, a lot of the people I talked to, you know, really pointed out how challenging it is to craft a really good foreign policy, because it's very easy to say, oh, we need to address the root causes of, you know, migration and violence. But how you go about doing that is a much, much harder thing. But Alex, you would probably know from your conversations with the Biden team that they are really trying to think very clearly about what that actually means. And sort of there had been a lot of emphasis on sort of security and putting money towards sort of, you know, trying to use kind of policing tactics to tackle gangs and stuff. So I don't mean to sound super like NGO-y, but there's more of an approach for a whole of society or whole of government approach, as they say, to really empower civil society groups that are already working on the ground and have connections to the community, but also putting less emphasis on the security situation and backing up the governments, and instead deferring to kind of outside bodies like, for example, this United Nations Truth Commission in Guatemala, and empowering organizations like that. To the larger point, I think one thing that I'm interested in, and Alex, you may encounter this in your reporting as well, is how this will be balanced with domestic policy, because it does tie in with the immigration debate. And I think I do not fully understand how grave our crisis is at the border, the fact that we have basically refugee camps on our southern border, how to untangle that. And, you know, I think it's going to involve, at least on some level, welcoming more people to the United States, how we do that and balance it out with, you know, kind of the domestic concerns, which, you know, have always, which, you know, if some would argue, it gave rise to Trump. So I think it's a really knotty situation that is, you know, we're right to pay attention to.
Yeah, I mean, very briefly, Biden has said, and I think has said explicitly in his book, you know, he feels that the U.S. has been a, quote, bully dictating policy to smaller countries, unquote. And he doesn't want that anymore. What he's advocated for is like a $4 billion aid plan to Central America to deal with issues of governance and corruption and violence. But he's really, it seems like, and this is early days, of course, but what his main goal is to kind of just get these countries back on America's side, in a sense. Right? Like, it's been a bad 4 years. We've done some really horrible things. And we've got a morality issue that we absolutely need to, on the border, that we absolutely need to clean up and, like, deal with and make sure people are treated with dignity and have a better life after that. But it's really to make, like, America not look as a bad place anymore, a country that, for nations in Central and South America that want to partner with us again. I should say one last bit on this. There is obviously a self-interest here, right? Like, it is good for the U.S. to have countries in the region be more on our side, perhaps not be countries that other people want to live in, so they don't necessarily want to come to the U.S. And the other bit here is, of course, China's making a massive play for influence in Latin America. And so the U.S. doesn't want that. So this is also a play to just kind of make sure China doesn't really have that much influence in Western Hemisphere, which is ironic because it's kind of Monroe Doctrine-y. But anyway.
Also, speaking of Cold War spheres of influence, remember how I said it wouldn't be a repeat of that? Well, whoops.
What about you, Jen?
My big thing that I am watching in 2021 is North Korea. Surprise, surprise.
Hey.
Longtime worldly listeners will know that North Korea is a subject that is near and dear to our hearts on this show, and we talk about it a lot. But that's because it's really important. They have a nuclear weapons program. They have intercontinental ballistic missiles that could potentially reach the U.S. homeland with a nuclear weapon, which is not great. They also, you know, have done things like threatening Japan. They like to test missiles that fly over Japan, things like that. It's also, you know, a horrifically repressive country. So I am watching that for one specific reason, which is that, you know, we have a new administration coming in. And, you know, Trump, for all of his faults, did take a fairly radical, you know, new approach toward dealing with North Korea in having, you know, direct one-on-one talks between him and Kim Jong-un, which was something that had never really happened before and, you know, was at least an attempt, you know, at doing something different and getting a breakthrough and trying to come to some sort of, you know, agreement on denuclearization. That didn't happen, right? Their end goals of all of that pomp and circumstance and all of those meetings and love letters and, you know, sending Elton John CDs because Trump calls him Little Rock. Yeah, Trump calls Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man. And so sent him a CD of Elton John, apparently, for that reason. But, you know, all of that didn't actually produce the kind of end goal policies that the administration hoped it would in terms of getting like a concrete agreement. You know, North Korea also didn't get what it wants, you know, relief from crippling economic sanctions. So, you know, we have a new administration coming in, and Pyongyang has a fairly well-documented track record of carrying out provocative actions early in the terms of U.S. presidents. So, you know, what I'm watching kind of really closely is when Biden comes into office, you know, does Kim Jong-un do something kind of big, spectacular, you know, testing an ICBM, you know, maybe a nuclear test, you know, and a lot of experts are worried about that. You know, essentially that would be a way for Kim Jong-un to kind of send up a flare saying, hey, I'm still here and you still have to deal with me. I'm still important. I still matter. I'm still threatening. And I think the fact that Biden will be dealing with so much, kind of so many other priorities, like the coronavirus, you know, trying to rebuild the U.S. economy, you know, after the economic downturn because of the pandemic, all sorts of things, you know, he's going to have a lot of priorities. And I suspect that North Korea is not particularly high on that list, kind of right away, as long as it kind of stays quiet. That's the thing, though, is that Kim Jong-un likes attention. He likes for the world to see him as, you know, a big, important world leader that has to be dealt with. And so, you know, I think a lot of experts, I definitely know, are worried that he could do something kind of early on in Biden's first, you know, first year even, to kind of get that attention. And what that means is that, you know, Biden and his administration will have to decide how to respond, right? They will have to do something, whether it's a strongly worded statement, whether it's something more serious, like that will force a decision. It will, you know, it will be effective in the sense that it will, you know, bring it to a head and force them to respond. And so, you know, I think that's something that I really want to watch, because I'm interested also in seeing, you know, what the Biden administration does. How do they respond? What is going to be their approach? Do they go back to the previous, you know, pre-Trump vision of you know, and strategy of working, you know, I don't want to say, you know, benign neglect, but strategic patience, I guess is what they called it, right? You know, do they try to kind of just limp along and try to, you know, deal with it kind of lower level? Do they try to launch some big diplomatic engagement? Do they capitalize on the relationship that was improved between the U.S. And Pyongyang, which is not something I ever thought I would say? You know, does Biden say, hey, I'm, you know, maybe I will meet with Kim? You know, I imagine they wouldn't do so. And Alex, you probably know more about this than the Biden side. You know, I imagine they probably wouldn't do so without getting some serious things done at the lower level first and actually having something to sign. But anyway, you know, I think North Korea has a really good way of making itself, you know, rocket, if you will, to the top of presidents, of U.S. presidents' list of things they have to deal with. So that is something I am watching super closely.
I mean, Biden has not shut the door on, like, Trump-like negotiations with Kim, having that sort of summit, but he has ruled out doing it just for the sake of having a summit. There needs to, like, it's going to be right. A reward, like it has been in the past. North Korea experts I'm talking to are pretty convinced, although, of course, it's North Korea, so it's hard to gauge, but pretty convinced that Kim actually won't be provocative as he has been in the past. In the first months of the Obama years and Trump years, he launched a missile to sort of bring himself to the top of the agenda. And it's totally possible he does so again. The reason some people believe he's not going to do it this time is because the U.S. is going to be so busy with coronavirus and the economy and a whole bunch of other things that this would give Kim a lot more time just to develop his weapons and arsenal even more while not, like, facing more problems from the U.S. Plus, it's got its own coronavirus issues in North Korea. So Biden then, I think, the way the administration sort of signaling is they're going to try the old style, right? Get a working group together in the U.S., like lower-level staff, try to bring some allies involved here.
We should definitely get some white papers. We should have some conferences.
Yeah, some think tank reports,
some
all that kind
panels.
Of stuff.
Panels.
Right.
Yeah, that'd be really great in advancing literally nothing.
Yeah, and then, like, but that's the plan, right? And so we'll see what happens, whether Biden sort of backtracks and thinks like, hey, Trump was onto something with that top-down approach. Maybe he shifts gears, but for the moment, it looks like a reversion to the mean.
That also is a bit of a, you know, troubling, you know, even if those experts are right and Kim Jong-un does kind of just, I'm going to sit here quietly and continue to improve my nuclear arsenal and my weapon systems, while everybody's looking the other way is also not like a great outcome. Like, yes, it's not forcing like a nuclear crisis, but it also means that their nuclear program is getting more robust, which means, you know, by the time that the Biden administration or, you know, whoever else, if it keeps kind of just going into a new administration, even by the time they do pay attention, they're going to have an even stronger, you know, North Korea in hand to have to deal with. So I think that either way, it's not a super, super great outlook that we've got.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Because it's sort of the North Korea crisis doesn't feel so present anymore because, you know, we don't have the nuclear tests and we don't have, you know, tweets about fire and fury. But because it's gone under the radar, North Korea has really been quietly developing its arsenal. And whenever the crisis emerges during Biden's presidency, it will seem as if it's new, even though it's been happening all of the time, which right. can will be hard for the Biden administration to deal with and also kind of communicate to the public of sort of why, how we got here, because it will sort of be off everyone's radar or it has been off everyone's radar for so long.
So that is what we are going to be watching in 2021 on top of all of the other things that are probably going to happen, things that we can't predict and won't expect, but we will be here to talk through all of it. As I said at the top of the show, this is going to be our last episode of 2020. We will be back in January, ready to talk about all the things that are going to be happening in 2021. Until then, wish you all happy holidays, happy new year. Please stay safe. Also, please, if you have good thoughts about Worldly, rate, subscribe, review wherever you get your podcasts. Send us emails with your thoughts, worldly@vox.com. I want to thank our producer, Jackson Bierfeldt, as always, for all of his amazing work this year. And also Bird Pinkerton, who did a lot of work on the show this year as well. I also want to thank Zach, who's not with us because he is on paternity leave. But we miss you, Zach, though we love having Kirby here as well. So we'll have to fight that out later. But everyone, happy new year. Take care, and we'll see you in 2021.
Bye.